proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
Well, congratulations to the Senate. Indeed, just moments ago, they passed the hate crimes bill. Moments ago, the Senate voted to expand the hate crimes law to include crimes motivated by gender, sexual orientation, or disability of the victims. And this is by more than 60 votes. In fact, it was exactly 60 votes. And so they could avoid a Republican filibuster. It's not the 67 votes necessary to avoid a presidential veto, but time will tell. Anyhow, greetings. Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. Our website, TomHartman.com, however you spell it, will probably get you there. And AirAmerica.com, blogging over at AirAmerica.com, our live chat room and our message boards over at TomHartman.com. And a lot in the news today. The presidential debates last night, there's going to be, well, first of all, tonight the Republicans are holding something. Paul Pimentel, the producer of the morning show here on KPOJ last hour, suggested that it should be called the reprobate. You can't call it a debate when the top four contenders don't show up. Giuliani's not going to show up. McCain's not going to show up. Thompson's not going to show up. I mean, and the lead Republicans are saying, nah, not going to do it. Tavis Smiley moderating the debate. If nothing else has writ large the racism of the Republican Party, I would say that this goes right to the top of the list. So anyhow, tonight there's the reprobate. But last night there was the debate, the Democratic debate, and some thoughts on this. Some interesting things happened. First of all, just a gestalt observation. Tim Russert, in my opinion, did a really good job of moderating this thing. And at the same time, there was an awful lot of this, okay, let's see what you can do in 30 seconds. Now, on the one hand, it moved along well, and it was really tight, and good on him for that. And it, because there are so many contenders in the field, it provided everybody an opportunity to say something. So I understand the necessity of it, and I thought it was handled quite elegantly. On the other hand, nobody is sitting around scratching their heads anymore saying, wait a minute, everything has to be reduced to a soundbite or it doesn't work. Because basically we're not having debates. We're having soundbite throwing competitions. If you can't say it in 30 seconds, if you can't say it in a minute, if you can't say it in a minute and a half or 2 minutes, it can't be said. And there are some issues that are more complex than a soundbite. And some of them were actually addressed last night, like Iraq, for example. Iraq. Excuse me. Learning how to pronounce these things correctly. But there were a variety of quick thoughts on this, and be interested to hear yours as well, on what happened last night in the Democratic debate. Some of the eyebrow raisers for me, Dennis Kucinich suggesting we should drop the voting age to 16 and the drinking age to 18. I frankly don't agree with either one. Mike Gravel, discovering that remember his America Initiative about a year ago, he was on this program, maybe a little longer than that, talking about this initiative that he had, that he, you know, basically to amend the Constitution that he was taking around the country. And I think he thought it was going to be the thing that was going to propel him into the race for the presidency. It was going to be the thing that would get him so much visibility, everybody would say, oh, wow, he's the man. And turns out he was putting it on his MasterCard and Visa, his credit cards. He ran up a $90,000 bill, and then he declared bankruptcy, personal bankruptcy. And Tim Russert, this is Mike Gravel, Tim Russert called him on it last night and said, how can we trust you to run the finances of the company, the country, when last year, the year before last, you declared personal bankruptcy to dispose of 90-some-odd thousand dollars worth of credit card debt? And he gets kind of feisty, and he says, well, I did that for America. Those credit card companies deserved it. And people in the audience are actually booing him. So I think that was probably a turning point for a turn into the cul-de-sac, into the dead-end road, maybe go off the edge of the cliff for Mike Gravel last night. The issue of Social Security was raised, and this was fascinating. I got an insight into the Democratic Party and processes that I had not had before. And it has to do with, you know, basically, bottom line, rich folks. We have a system in the United States where you can't get elected president if you don't get a lot of people giving you a lot of money, and that includes a lot of people who have incomes over $97,000 a year. Well, the way that Social Security is set up right now, Tim Russert pointed out right now I don't remember the number. My recollection is 20 million is going to 40 million. It might have been double that. But in any case, right now there's X number of people on Social Security, and in 25 years, more or less, there's going to be about double that number of people. And really, there's only two ways to deal with this, or the rational ways that have been proposed. One is to cut the benefits, which ain't going to fly. I mean, right now, Social Security benefits are almost impossible to live on. And the other is to increase taxes substantially. And what I find so interesting is the way this is being dealt with in the media. You know, for example, MSNBC, MSNBC.com, when they're talking about the raising the tax, their phrase was several of the contenders endorsed payroll tax increases. And then they go on to say, Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware, Representative Dennis Kucinich, as well as Dodd, Obama, Edwards, all said they would apply the tax to income now exempted. Richardson said he wouldn't, and Clinton refused to say. Now, this is what it sounds like, is that all the Democrats are talking about raising taxes. And here's the situation. If you earn more than $97,000 a year, you don't pay a penny of Social Security taxes on anything you earn after $97,000 a year. I remember the first time this happened to me many years ago. At that time, it was around $30,000, something like that. I was running an advertising agency in Michigan, and I made more than the Social Security cap. And I'd never done that in my life. And at the end of the year, the guy who does our taxes came back and he says, okay, you're going to get a whole bunch of money back because you deducted from your pay more than, as I recall back then, this was like in the late 70s, early 80s, it was like $36,000 or something. You deducted Social Security. And I'm like, what? And he said, yeah, once you make after a certain amount, you don't have to pay Social Security taxes anymore. And I said, why not? And he said, because they set it up so rich people don't have to pay Social Security taxes, just working people. And I'm like, why is that? He says, because probably rich people wrote the law. So the question, I mean, it's really simple. You want to solve the Social Security problem. You want to make the Social Security system completely solid for all eternity. All you have to do is maintain the current tax rate, not increase it at all. Just do away with that cap and say somebody who makes more than $97,000 is going to continue paying taxes, Social Security taxes on their income, just like somebody who makes less than $97,000. So right now, if you make $20,000, you make $40,000, you make $60,000, you make $80,000, you make $97,000, 100% of that income gets taxed at the roughly 7% rate for Social Security, and then your employer matches it. But if you make $200,000 a year, $103,000 a year income, you pay no income tax or no Social Security tax, whatsoever on it. If you make $1 million a year on $900,000 and $903,000 a year income, you pay no Social Security tax whatsoever on it. If you make $50 million a year on $49,903,000, you pay no Social Security tax whatsoever. And so the question, the real simple question Tim Russert asked is, are you willing to just do away with the cap? Because that'll solve the problem. And I thought, this is a no-brainer. All of these guys are going to say yes. This is not rocket science. And Dennis Kucinich and Joe Biden and Chris Dodd and Obama. Actually, I think it was Chris Dodd was the first who said, yeah, no problem. I'd do that. Dennis Kucinich John Edwards nuanced it slightly. He said yes, but he said people who are making between $97,000 and $200,000 in some cities, in some places, where it's really expensive to live, San Francisco, Manhattan, that's still the middle class, and that might be a two-wage earner family. And he said, so he would not, what he would do is he'd have a kick in starting at $200,000. He'd have a donut hole, essentially, between the $97,000 and $200,000. And I thought, wow, that's a really elegant solution. But he says, over $200,000, absolutely. And Hillary Clinton says, no, I'm not going to tell you. And I'm like, why? Well, and then suddenly it hit me. Some of the Democratic donors, Republican as well, are people who make $1 million a year, and they're very happy with the fact that if you make $1 million a year, the first 990, the 900 and what would it be, $903,000 of income, you don't pay any Social Security tax on. So you get a 7%, you know, bonus, essentially. I was really, frankly, quite surprised by that. A couple of other interesting things on this, and we've got a lot of other news going on today. We'll be covering. Stick around. 16 minutes past it.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
With a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line, flag on the wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore.
Yeah, the tragedy of America. Welcome back. The Democratic debate last night, and there's a number of other things in the news, but one of the aspects of it was Iraq, which suggests perhaps first we should take a look at what's going on with the ongoing occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
Following our security developments in Iraq, as of Thursday, 11:30 GMT from Reuters, Dateline Baghdad, U.S. forces detained 21 suspected insurgents during operations Wednesday and Thursday in Samarra, Baiji, and Baghdad. Baghdad, U.S. forces killed one insurgent, detained two suspected members of Iran-backed special groups during an operation in northern Baghdad. Baghdad's seven bodies were found in different parts of Baghdad on Wednesday. Baghdad, a car bomb near a mosque killed one person, wounded two in eastern Baghdad. In Nasiriya, a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol killed two policemen and wounded three. In Baghdad, a car bomb near a mosque wounded five people in the Ur district. In Hawija, a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol killed a police officer and wounded three. In Riyadh, a gunman killed two brothers in a drive-by shooting. And in Kirkuk, gunman killed an off-duty soldier in a drive-by shooting on Wednesday, which brings us to the issue of Iraq in the debate last night. That was the Democratic presidential debate. It seems that for everybody except John Edwards and Dennis Kucinich and perhaps Bill Richardson, I wasn't quite clear to me, the new withdrawal date is 2013. And Edwards, in this debate, was differentiating himself significantly from Hillary Clinton and many of the others on this issue, and I think he did it very well. This was John Edwards last night.
It's true that everyone up here wants to take a responsible course to end the war in Iraq. There are, however, differences between us, and those differences need to be made aware. Good people have differences about this issue. For example, I heard Senator Clinton say on Sunday that she wants to continue combat missions in Iraq. To me, that's a continuation of the war. I do not think we should continue combat missions in Iraq. And when I'm on a stage with the Republican nominee come the fall of 2008, I'm going to make it clear that I'm for ending the war. And the debate will be between a Democrat who wants to bring the war to an end, get all American combat troops out of Iraq, and a Republican who wants to continue the war.
Governor Richardson, could I just clarify that?
And at this point, Hillary Clinton jumps in and says, no, wait a minute. You can't trash me. I'm going to have my say here.
You know, I said there may be a continuing counterterrorism mission, which, if it still exists, will be aimed at Al-Qaeda in Iraq. it may require combat, special operations forces or some other form of that, but the vast majority of our combat troops should be out.
But
And then John Edwards comes back and says, not quite.
Can I just say that my only point is, I don't have any doubt that Senator Clinton wants to take a responsible course. There is a difference, however, in how we would go about this. And I think Democratic primary voters are entitled to know that difference. And the difference is really very simple. I would have our combat troops out of Iraq over a period of several months, and I would not continue combat missions in Iraq. Combat missions mean that the war is continuing. I believe this war needs to be brought to an end.
Would you send combat troops back in if there was genocide?
I believe that America, along with the rest of the world, would have a responsibility to respond to genocide. It's not something we should do alone. In fact, if we do it alone, it could be counterproductive. In fact, if I can go one step further beyond what you just asked, I think the President of the United States and I as President would have a responsibility as we begin to bring our combat troops out of Iraq to prepare for two possibilities. One is the possibility that the worst possibility, which is a genocide breaks out, Shia try to systematically eliminate the Sunni. I think we need to be preparing for that with the international community now, not waiting. And second, the possibility that this war starts to spill outside the borders of Iraq. And that's a very difficult thing to contain, because we know historically that it's difficult to contain civil war.
Those excellent points. Other points that were made, Gravel. Mike Gravel, I told you about his disaster moment when he was called on his bankruptcy. His high point, the high point for Mike Gravel, was when he called out the other senators on the stage and said, you guys want to end the war? You guys want to override Republican vetoes? For that matter, in the House of Representatives, Congressman Kucinich, you want to just have a vote day after day after day. Just keep revoting. Keep revoting. Say, no, we are going to vote for cloture. We're going to vote for cloture. You guys are going to have to stand and filibuster. If it takes 40 days to do it, it takes 40 days to do it. And everybody kind of treated him like he was, you know, the cranky uncle. But I thought he was, really well said. And they all strongly were opposed to torture. Although Hillary seemed to disagree with her husband, and according to today's New York Daily News, disagree with herself on this issue. But I thought she handled the question quite elegantly and very well. In fact, she was the one who had given the speech some time back about George Washington telling his soldiers, when you take prisoners, treat them well, and how well that turned out for us in the Revolutionary War. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. Now
I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
Yes, those liberals. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Some crazy stuff out there on the internets. Indeed, just days after this, from the wire services, as they say, just days after asserting that there were no homosexuals in Iran, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad today invited United Nations inspectors into his country to search for homosexuals. We have nothing to hide, Mr. Ahmadinejad said in a speech to the United Nations General Assembly. You can search the entire country, even the airport bathrooms. While some senior U.S. diplomats expressed skepticism about the Iranian president's offer to allow U.N. inspectors to search his country for homosexuals, Mr. Ahmadinejad attempted to silence the skeptics by permitting the use of, quote, advanced gaydar technology, end quote, as part of the proposed inspections. In Iran, we have the most advanced gaydar in the world, and we are prepared to share it with you, he said. In the immediate aftermath of Mr. Ahmadinejad's speech, it was unclear as to who would lead the U.N. inspections efforts, but most diplomats assumed that the task would fall to Mohammed Al-Baradei, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA. At a press conference at the UN, Mr. Al-Baradei acknowledged that he had no previous experience searching for gays, but said that if chosen to lead the inspection effort, he would make sure that the inspections were rigorous and thorough. Mr. Al-Baradei said, the possibility that Iran may possess homosexuals is a serious matter to the world community. There has been some evidence for some time that Iran may be attempting to build a Broadway musical. Thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, for that little bit lighter side of the news. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I took a little umbrage last night in the debate at the question of what's your favorite Bible passage. You know, my favorite Bible passage for that question would have been, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States.
It's in Article 2 of the Constitution, as I recall, isn't it, or Article 4?
I know that they like that in book and verse form for the studio, so that's Article 6, Section 3.
Article 6, thank you. Okay, thank you Dave, interesting point. I thought it was interesting that a couple of people did not even quote the Bible, actually, and I kept going, well, wait a minute, that's not in the Bible. But, it's sort of, you know, how religious are you? On the other hand, Tim Russert was with the... quote, faith voters, end quote. I think he was giving the Democrats, he was doing them a favor, giving them an opportunity to say something, you know, it's to say something that would appeal to them. There are, we've discussed on the program. Liz in Los Angeles. Hey, Liz.
Hi, Tom. Good morning. I've listened to you for some time, and I've enjoyed your program, but I have to say lately I'm beginning to disagree with you. And it does upset me because I do respect you. As far as Tim Russert last night, I thought he did a lousy job. I mean, he had Hillary Clinton, and I'm not trying to bash her. I'm not for her or against her. But every question that he started with her, and it seemed like he never limited her 30 seconds when that was it. And, I'm tired of the press picking the candidate. I mean, gosh.
They've very much done that, Liz. I agree with you. And in fact, afterwards, I was astounded. Chris Matthews was interviewing Joe Biden, and all his questions that he was asking of Joe Biden were about Hillary Clinton.
Well,
and you know,
probably because he's going to be her vice president, maybe. I don't know.
No, it's exactly what you're saying, Liz. Yeah. It's because these guys have decided that Hillary is the presumptive nominee, and it's up to somebody to knock her off, I guess. So, you know, knock her off that perch, enough on that. Gene in Detroit. Thanks, Liz, for the call. Hey, Gene.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Good. Hey, Tom, I think Hillary Clinton was very disappointing last night, and I think the Social Security, how you so eloquently detailed the Social Security issue, I thought was terrific. You did a great job on that. And also, I am in despair right now for the simple fact, you know, I got to the point now, I don't even think I'm going to vote. If we can't
that's exactly what the Republicans want. I mean, that's exactly what the Republicans want, is they want you not to vote.
Tom, if we can't get Edwards or Biden or a Kucinich on the Democratic as a president running, I'm not going to vote.
Yeah. I got to tell you, Gene, as much as Hillary Clinton is not my first choice for nominee for the Democratic Party, and she's absolutely not, if she was the nominee, she would be a better president than any Republican. Excuse me. The Republicans. I mean, we are faced with a Republican lineup that runs from the right to the Reich, and you know, Hillary, in my mind, is you know, a little, you know, far more what the mainstream press calls center, what I call corporatist, for my taste, frankly. But if she's the nominee, I'll vote for her.
She's for me.
Yeah, well, I get it, Gene. I get it. But I think that we all need to take a deep breath and consider, for example, this is a big one. I mean, this is a really big one. Paul Weyrich, the Republican strategist, some years ago made this comment in front of a group of Republicans who were meeting in a church.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
You get it? The Republicans are all about dampening the vote, tamping down the vote, upsetting people with their choices and all that kind of thing. And this story out of McClatchy Newspapers, Greg Gordon writing, this is astounding. Ohio and Florida laws could dampen Democratic voting is the headline. Ohio and Florida, which provided the decisive electoral votes for President Bush's two razor-thin national election triumph, have enacted laws that election experts say will help Republicans impede Democratic-leaning minorities from voting in 2008. They said backers of the new laws say they're aimed at curbing vote fraud, but the statutes could also facilitate a controversial Republican tactic known as vote caging, which the GOP attempted in Ohio and Florida in 2004 before public disclosures foiled the efforts, said Joseph Rich, a former Justice Department voting rights chief in the Bush administration. I would say, actually, they did it and they got away with it, is what happened. Caging, using the past to target poor minorities in heavily Democratic districts, precincts, entails sending mass mailings to certain voters and then using the undelivered letters to compile lists of voters for eligibility challenges. So they stop you at the polls and they say, I'm going to challenge you. You can't vote. If you look like you might be a Democrat or if your name is on their list. And then they go on to point out, Republican political appointees in the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division have endorsed some of these measures. Over the last 3 years, Republican-controlled state legislatures in Indiana, Georgia, Missouri, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin have all passed laws requiring every voter to produce a photo ID card, measures that civil rights groups contend are aimed at suppressing minority voting. In Ohio, which swung the 2004 election to Bush, the new Democratic Secretary of State, Jennifer Brunner, said in a phone interview that an election law passed last year and signed by former Republican Governor Bob Taft effectively, quote, institutionalized vote caging. She's beside herself. She says the law requires that the state's 88 election county boards send non-forwardable pre-election notices to all 7.8 million registered Ohio voters at least 60 days before the elections. Undeliverable letters are public record, she said, meaning that, quote, effectively now the counties are paying for the data needed to compile challenge lists. This is called caging. In addition, Brunner said the tough voter ID requirements took away the rights of some voters to be heard about whether or not their registration is valid. In the past, Ohio voters were entitled to an official notice and a hearing before an election board, before the board could declare them ineligible. But the new law says the board can make that decision without a notice. A disqualified voter who shows up at the polls must demonstrate that he's fixed any eligibility problem or opt for filing a provisional ballot, which may not be counted. I mean, keep in mind, they still haven't counted the provisional ballots in Ohio from the 2004 election. Over 160,000 of them. Brunner said the new law, this is the Secretary of State of Ohio, said the new law has left her feeling like being in a sword fight with one hand behind your back. In a 2005 Florida law approved by the Justice Department of the Voting Rights Act stripped that state's 10.5 million registered voters of the right to contest changes at the polls. Now, if a Republican wants to try to stop in a heavily Democratic area, if they want to try and stop people from voting, they only have to, quote, swear a good faith belief, end quote, that the voter is ineligible in order to force that voter to file a provisional ballot. In other words, a placebo ballot, a ballot that probably won't be counted. At the same time, the law reduces from 3 days to 48 hours the deadline for challenged voters to produce evidence that they're eligible to vote. Another Florida law imposed a $250 penalty on voter registration workers for every registration application they failed to turn over to county registrars within 10 days. In other words, stopping efforts to get more people, more largely Democrats, registered to vote. You get it? It's about suppressing the vote. It's about driving down the number of people who are voting. It's that Paul Weyrich thing. You know, we don't want people voting.
Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
This is the Republican strategy for 2008, institutionalized voting caging and making us apathetic. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
passed away. It's Thurston Howell III. She doesn't like big government, so it's no surprise I can be her lover long as I downsize. My conservative girlfriend got a tiny little heart full of passion. My conservative girlfriend, every Friday we go liberal bashing. She got the Supreme Court,
Supreme Court,
tattooed on her bum,
tattooed on her bum,
beside an autograph port,
autograph port,
drink Donald Rum,
spelled.
Oh man, this is getting me too much for me. nine minutes before the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Oh my. By the way, the American economy continuing to be hollowed out at a near record pace. Economyandcrisis.org sending out an alert here. This year, foreign companies have acquired $129 billion worth of American companies, a record, an all-time record. They note that Japan and China regard their companies as sacred wealth-producing facilities. Their companies are not for sale. Ours are. Why? Because, it looks like we're going to borrow a couple hundred billion dollars for Iraq. All right? And you borrow money, you got to give somebody something in exchange for it. By the way, not this weekend, but the weekend after this, October 6th, Saturday, I'll be speaking at the Green Festival at 6 p.m. in the main stage in the Washington Green Festival in Washington, D.C. Conference Center. So if you be out Washington, D.C. way, drop by and say hi. Mike in New Orleans. Hey, Mike, you got an event in New Orleans you wanted to mention?
Yeah, Mr. Hartman, I'd just like to thank you. It's such an honor to speak to you. You're a blessed soul. I really appreciate all that you do. And actually, I fell asleep. Tim Russett was pretty bad last night. I missed the last 50 minutes of it. Hey, we're having a march against the war here in New Orleans on Saturday, September 29th at 4 p.m. We're going to meet up at Washington Square. We're going to march down Royal Street to the Louisiana Supreme Court at 400 Royal Street. You can get more information at nocaw.org.
Great. Mike, thanks a lot for the heads up, and thanks for the plug. Dorothy in Minnesota. Hey, Dorothy, welcome to the program.
Hi. I can't hear you very well.
Can you hear me now? I sound like I'm in a bad cell phone.
Okay, now we're better. All right.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to say thank you for all that you do. Also, that I agree that the most important issues right now are paper ballots and election reform. But on to that, I wanted to talk about the sense of the Senate on Iran yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
This vote where, let's see, how many senators said yes to it? I'd like to say one section of it that just has me physically ill. It says, it is the sense of the Senate, I'm skipping down, that it is a vital national interest of the United States to prevent the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran from turning Shia militia extremists in Iraq to a Hezbollah-like force that could serve its interests inside Iraq, including by overwhelming, subverting, or co-opting institutions of the legitimate government of Iraq. So I'm very frightened.
I agree with you, Dorothy. And in fact, you know, we talked about this before the vote. We talked about it at the vote, during the vote, after the vote. This is the beginning of a ramp up to justifying the bombing of Iran. I mean, there's just no other way around it. This is a setup for the beginning of a war against, if not a war, at least a substantial act of aggression against Iran. And, you know, I really think the Bushes are going to do this before they go out of office. I think they're going to do it for a variety of reasons, one of which is that they think it's going to help Republican nominees and candidates in the election, oddly enough. You know, the rally around, oh, the country's at war, we've got to rally around the party in power, the commander, blah-de-blah, number one. And number two, I think that they're doing it because they think it is going to help maintain the ongoing occupation of Iran, of Iraq. So they're going to attack Iran, if I've been saying Iraq, I mean Iran, and it'll help maintain the ongoing occupation. By the way, it also seems that the Democrats, by and large, have bought into the frame, which I, you know, wrote an op-ed piece a year and a half ago or more longer at Common Dreams saying, hey, wait a minute, don't use this frame of war in Iraq instead of the frame of occupation. If any of the Democratic candidates would start talking about the occupation of Iraq, then it would make perfect sense to end the occupation and get out. But instead, you know, they're out there talking about, no, it's a war. I think that's just, you know, wrong, frankly. Carl in Chicago. Hey, Carl, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling regarding, and thanks for taking my call. I'm calling regarding an exchange from last night's debate as it relates to the previous caller's comment that the media is selecting our candidate.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't authoritative, of course. It's just, to me, it's more of a sign of the depths to which my trust in the traditional media has dropped, especially for those that can join with the corporate America, as Russert, you know, best friend forever of Jack Welch. Russert posed a question to Hillary Clinton regarding the scenario. Who would you know, would you torture the third man in Al-Qaeda to prevent imminent bombing? You know, would you torture him?
Right.
Saying that he had a conversation with someone who supported that approach. And then, you know, he tried tricking her up after her statement to say, you know, it was William Jefferson Clinton.
Right.
Right. And then, you know, after his back and forth with her, he then took the question to other people. You know,
actually he ended up with her.
Was it President? Do you agree with President Clinton? You know, was he asking, do they agree with Bill? Or was he trying to, you know, implant in people's minds, those, you know, the viewers, that Hillary is President Clinton?
I don't think he's that subtle. I just think that there is this broad media perception, not perception. I think, you know, Hillary is the candidate that corporate America would like the most on the Democratic side, and so they're pushing her. I think that John Edwards is the candidate that corporate America fears the most, and so they're trying to ignore him.
Yeah,
and Barack Obama is somewhere in the middle. And
yeah,
he's trying to become,
that's why I said maybe just mostly it's more a sign of my distrust of Russert than the traditional media.
Yeah.
Quick question, Tom.
Sure.
If I could, very fast. At some point, I'd like to hear more about this Hunt Oil deal with Kuwait, and how is Hunt Oil not being prosecuted for treason? I mean, if we know the biggest thing in Iraq is politics, they totally, you know, hamstrung politics now.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good question. We did discuss that a few weeks ago. We'll have to get back to it one of these days soon. There's so much in the news. Carl, thanks a lot for the call. Is America becoming a nanny state? Or do we just want the corporatists to take over? That topic up next. Stick around. 57 minutes past.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And welcome back to our program. For the last 26 years, nanny state conservatives have been cranking up a corporate nanny state to protect folks like Bill Gates with nanny state laws like copyright and trademark protection, protecting Disney. Let's extend these protections to 75 years so you can make more money on the mouse. Nanny state laws that allow multinational corporations, over 10,000 actually pages of laws involved in the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade and the World Trade Organization that allow transnational multinational corporations to essentially screw the American worker and America in general. Nanny state conservatives changing tax code and changing laws so that CEOs now make 400 or 500 times what the average worker makes. As the nanny state conservatives have gained more and more power, we've seen more and more of the protections of average Americans eroding and the lifestyle of average Americans eroding. Into this comes David Harsanyi. He has written a book that's sort of the, views a completely different nanny state than the one that I've been watching ever since Ronald Reagan became president. His book, Nanny State, How Food Fascists, Teetotaling Do-Gooders, Priggish Moralists, and Other Boneheaded Bureaucrats Are Turning America into a Nation of Children. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We've got these nanny state laws that are transferring hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars into the pockets of a very small and very powerful elite. You've got the Walton family collectively, the five heirs of Sam Walton with their hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, spending millions of dollars secretively to change, for example, the notion of inheritance tax to death tax and stuff like this. I mean, you've got all these nanny state protections for the rich and the ultra rich. Why should we care about whether or not people are wearing seatbelts?
Well, I mean, you know, you have a different definition of the nanny state than I do. I'm not you know, I'm not going to argue those things. It's a different topic from the book. But how I look at it is that when we start small with things that may seem piddling to the average American, when you add them up, they become a paternalistic movement that undermines our choices. Perhaps not as important as the larger issues that we deal with, but I think small things can lead to big things.
That's well, I would submit that they have. I mean, you know, one of the examples that you, and actually there's this kind of this issue of moral hazard. One of the examples that you talk about in the book is that when people wear seatbelts, you suggest, or when seatbelts are mandated, when seatbelt use is mandated, that people tend to engage in more hazardous behavior. You want to riff on that for a second?
Well, there are a couple of studies done on risk, and when we feel safer, we act more recklessly. I think that makes sense on some level. I'm not going to say that that's the only reason, but you know, seatbelts are a small part of it. I think that's where it began, on the level I'm talking about, where government said you're too stupid to take care of yourself. We're going to take care of you, not protect you from evil corporations or bad government, but just protect you from yourself. And that's basically where I come in.
I don't recall government ever saying that we're too stupid to take care of ourselves. My understanding is that most of these have been framed in the context of what's the benefit of the individual versus the benefit of society. That if we, the people, collectively are paying hundreds of millions of dollars a year for head injuries, for example, closed head injuries, as a consequence of people not wearing helmets when they drive on motorcycles, and if we simply mandate that people wear helmets when they drive on motorcycles, we're going to pay less out of our pocket, and you're going to have fewer people die. That's, you know, it's a diminution of freedom, I'll give you. I acknowledge that. And at the same time, it's a benefit to society.
Well, I would...
has nothing to do with being stupid.
Well, it's clear with motorcycle helmets that probably is true, and the externalities argument in the sense that we pay for other people's bad habits is the strongest argument for the nanny state, that how I define it. But that's a slippery slope in the sense that, how about promiscuity? I mean, we could say that costs society a ton of money, you know, on every level, or a million other things. I mean, I think, you know, that leads to intrusions that we don't want. Now, motorcycle helmets and seatbelts make sense to most people, but do food portions make sense to people? Does banning smoking in your own home make sense to people? Perhaps, but I think that those are intrusions that defy or jump over the line in which government should be in our lives.
Well, you know, banning smoking in your own home, what if you have a two-year-old? Does that two-year-old have a say in it?
It's very tough when you deal with children. I admit that, but I don't know if government can parent. I mean, you know, is it okay to give kids donuts all the time? I don't think so. I wouldn't do it with my children. But when government tells me what I should feed my kids, that to me feels
donuts
like
are not an addictive drug, five times more addictive than heroin. Tobacco is.
I understand, but
I don't think there's any laws, and nobody's proposing laws to ban donuts in homes.
No, but there are. Groups and out there that would like to regulate food on almost every level and what we eat, because we have an obesity epidemic in this country.
Sure. No, I understand. And David, I think that actually the relatively libertarian position you're taking in your book, and the position of many liberals, for lack of a better word, many Americans, let's say, I think is probably not all that far apart in some regards, in as much as that in the middle ground, I would say, you know, yeah, there's a lot of things. I really don't want the government sticking its nose in my life. Or for that matter, I don't want Verizon sticking its nose in my life and telling me that I can't engage in a relationship with NARAL, you know, the pro-choice movement, so that I can text them my phone number and they will send me an alert when they're going to have a demonstration in my area. They just today reversed their position, but here you had a corporation making a nanny state decision for us.
Well,
in the middle ground. But there's a bottom ground. There's a minimum threshold of that is necessary for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, of safety of all of us. That I don't see how we can avoid organizing ourselves as a society through government to protect ourselves from predators out there or from stupidity out there. Things like, you know, lead in paint or, you know, toxic food. I mean, why would you call these nanny state things? It seems to me like this is just like this is the purpose of government.
Well, I've never called those things that you just mentioned nanny state initiatives. And I would also argue as a libertarian that with Verizon you have another, you know, 15 choices that you could make. With government,
if you have a 2-year contract.
Well, true, but that's beyond the scope of my book, but I understand your point. I mean, we're invaded all the time by all kinds of entities, you know, powerful entities, but I think that government protecting us from hidden dangers and transparency as far as convincing us and telling us what the problems are with bad donuts and smoking. And that's fine. I think when they jump over the line of coercion, especially when it comes to adults, that they've invaded, that they've gone into an area they shouldn't. For instance, if I own a bar and I clearly state that smoking is allowed in this bar, people have choice to come in or not, I don't see why the government has to invade that choice.
Well, I think the argument is that somebody may work in that bar who doesn't smoke, and you know, that's again one of those areas where it's a little tougher because there is another example
that's sure. You know, common sense has a lot to do with this, I think. When you ban tag in a school, I think that defies common sense. But common sense is also subjective, and you said we have to sort of organize culture in a way or help society sort of draw the lines and parameters for safety. And
there need to be rational thresholds.
Yeah, but, you know, a social conservative will have a completely different view of that than you. They will have a more, you know, they will want the FCC to regulate cable television and satellite television as far as speech goes. Now, I don't want either of those people in my life.
No, I understand. And that's why, you know, having a society where you've got the moral conservatives, having a society where you have liberals, and having a society where you have libertarians, and having us all decide collectively is a good idea, and we're going to end up at the middle ground. Whereas if we simply went down the libertarian road that you're suggesting, we're going to end up with Verizon making all our decisions for us.
Well, I understand that argument, and I would say this. I think that when we talk about safety and these issues, and it happens typically on a local level, the laws I'm talking about grow from there, very rarely do these people ever take into consideration choice or freedom of speech or any of those issues. It's not part of the conversation anymore. That's really what this book is about. I think that we've, and on a bigger level, from Bush all the way to my city councilman, I think that these people are invading my freedom of speech, my ability to make the wrong choice occasionally in my pursuit of happiness.
But they're accountable to you. You can vote them out of office.
That's right. I think that we, in the end, are at fault because, first of all, most people don't even know what's going on in local government, even though those people have tremendous power over our lives. I think that's a big problem in this country. But you're right. We have to, you know, when people say they're helpless or act as if they're victims to government, it's our fault. We need to get rid of people who aren't defending our freedom.
And what about when we feel like we're victims to corporations?
Typically, we have choices.
Verizon, for example, saying that, no, you can't text the National Libertarian Party. We don't like it. And you got a two-year contract. It's going to cost you a fortune to break it.
Well, obviously, you know, we can't have instantaneously make that change. But I would never, if I knew that, and if that's true, I would drop Verizon and go to another company that does allow me the freedom to get those messages.
Except that you have this contract because of the corporate nanny state.
Well, then someone needs to sue because it seems to me that that's an infringement on my freedom of speech, especially if they allow other messages to go out.
Yeah. Interesting conversation. David Harsanyi is the author. The book is Nanny State. DavidHarsanyi.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. By the way, coming up a little later on in the hour, Reverend Billy of the Church of Stop Shopping is going to drop by on his new documentary, What Would Jesus Buy? Reverend Billy's a real character, and you're going to love it. Mayor Bloomberg last night suggested that the United States, this from the New York Post, the Rupert Murdoch's New York Post, suggested last night the United States is in the same difficult position as the British in the Revolutionary War, facing a determined band of insurgents. He says, we're the British with regard to Iraq. He says, I'm not suggesting the motives are the same. I'm just pointing out that this was an insurgent kind of attack on trained, disciplined, uniformed soldiers who fought in a rigorously planned way, and we're trying to adjust to that. Okay. So anyhow, with regard to the debate the conversation we just had with David Harsanyi, do we want a nanny state or a corporate state? Nanny state is one of the favorite frames of the cons. It's why it is, in fact, I would submit to you that it is probably the favorite conservative frame. And what it completely omits is that a corporation cannot do business without the state. That it can't do business without the state creating laws that define what the medium of exchange is, creating a currency, creating a court system to enforce that those laws, without particularly laws that protect intangibles. Dean Baker wrote a book called The Corporate Nanny State, and in which he pointed out that, or The Conservative Nanny State, excuse me, Dean Baker's book. In fact, it was one of my book of the months over at BuzzFlash.com some about a year or so ago. You can probably still find it if you go to TomHartmann.com, click Articles on Democracy, and there's a link to the whole archive of them there. In which he calls out Bill Gates and says he's America's biggest welfare queen because, you know, he's made money based on a law that was passed that protects intellectual properties in a very particular way that made Bill Gates a billionaire. And without that law, Bill Gates would have merely been a millionaire. And there probably would have been a lot more competitors for Microsoft, and we all wouldn't be using Windows. So the conservatives love this frame of the nanny state. And libertarians love this frame of, oh, you know, the government thinks we're too stupid to, and I'm sorry, it's not, first of all, the government is not a them over there. It's an us right here. At least to the extent that we're still participating in it. And that's the important thing, is that we have to remember to still participate in it. You know, we have to get in there and get active. But it's us. And the extent to which the conservatives are going, oh, no, the government is of them. It's over there. Yeah, that's because, as Paul Weyrich pointed out,
by a majority of people, they never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And similarly, I would suggest that the leverage of corporatists, those who want to have to make sure that to the extent that you want to call it a nanny state, that the corporate nanny state is intact, that there are that people who earn over $97,000 a year don't have to pay any Social Security tax whatsoever, for example, on the money that they make after the first $97,000. Or for that matter, that the corporations who are paying those people more than $97,000 don't have to make a matching payment on anything over $97,000. That corporate nanny state is intact. They want that. Oh, that is so important to them. I mean, this may even have something to do with why Senator Clinton last night was waffling on the issue of eliminating the Social Security cap. Why a couple of the candidates, in fact, were waffling on it. Is because if you do away with the Social Security cap, somebody's making $1 million income, they're going to pay 7% FICA tax. They're going to pay the 7% Social Security tax on their entire $1 million worth of income. Right now, they only pay it on the first $97,000. But their corporation is also going to pay a matching amount on the entire $1 million. So if you're trying to be friendly to the corporations, they don't like that. And that was my point where I said I thought that John Edwards had come up with an elegant solution. And perhaps that word is a bit of an overstatement. But his suggestion was that in many cities in America, earning $150,000 a year, $100,000 a year doesn't make you rich. But nobody's going to dispute that earning a couple $1 million a year makes you rich no matter where you live. So by John Edwards suggesting that for the moment, let's not hit people with a sudden tax increase between $97,000 and $200,000, but anybody earning over $200,000, fine, they can afford it. Lay it on. It's also going to hit the corporations because they pay, you know, they match that Social Security amount. And those corporations that want the nanny state, the corporate nanny state that keeps protecting them, that makes them rich, that keeps their taxes low, they're going to say, no, don't like that at all. And so it's interesting. It's an interesting debate. It's an interesting topic. And in particular, I think it's an interesting frame, and it's it's amazing to me that for the better part of 30 years, since the Heritage Foundation and these other think tanks that were first funded by these hard Reich guys first came out with this frame of the nanny state, that it is only now that we're starting to push back and say, wait a minute, what about the corporate nanny state? 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, or will be next weekend, that is the weekend of October 6th, the Washington Green Festival is going on, and on Saturday, the 6th of October at 6 p.m., I'll be speaking at the main stage. So if you're there, be there or be square. Okay, do you want a nanny state or maybe a bunch of nannies in the form of wives? Does that sound too sexist? I'm not sure. Here, a Saudi man had lost a bit of his nose in a joint assault by his two wives after he jokingly threatened to marry a third woman. Uh-oh. Juba ibn Salam had thought his threat would help resolve an argument over dividing up the house. He said, "I never realized they get so worked up. The only way to restore my dignity is to take a third wife. I don't know what I'm going to do next." Islamic law allows men to take four wives, and polygamy is common in Saudi Arabia. But apparently one of his wives bit off the end of his nose. Not a good idea. Well, maybe there are times when you want the state to intervene. I realize this is really stretching the metaphor. Chuck in Carlsbad, California. Hey, Chuck, welcome to the program.
Good morning. The nanny gate thing, you know, it's just a part of the effort of the Republicans to feminize the Democratic Liberal Party. But the thing I hear that they have the cameras out here on the traffic corners, and right. I mean this is nanny gate towards Big Brotherism. You know, it's just horrible. And the worst,
you know, in Chicago right now, if you're lost and you drive around a block three times, the cameras automatically take a picture of your license plate and report you to the police.
Yeah, I mean, this is wild here. They cost you like almost $400 by the time you do everything over $1,000, you know, because of this and a point off of your record. Whereas they found that back east, it's just as effective. They charge you $50 and no points off your record. I put this to a police officer, and he said, yeah, the police out here favored, you know, the lesser penalty, but the insurance companies demanded that they do this so that they can charge more for your insurance, up your rates, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a prime example right in the local.
So if you get – actually, I would say that the insurance companies would demand the points, not the dollars, because if you've got points on your records, then the insurance companies can justify jacking up your insurance rates, regardless of how many dollars you pay to the state.
Well, and in general, I just think, you know, this corporate – capitalism and corporate.
This is, let me just to clarify, you're talking about things like these cameras that catch you when you're speeding or when you run a red light, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's Big Brother coming home to roost. And I think the corporate structure we have here, capitalism is like a big, beautiful tiger. It's part of nature. It's essential. But if you don't curb it, it'll eat you.
Yeah. Well said. Well said, Chuck. Thanks a lot. Steve in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Steve.
Oh, hi, Tom. Really like your show. I just wanted to comment about your guest today. You said that, or rather, he uses this argument called the slippery slope. And I get so tired of conservatives and libertarians using that argument. You know, the slippery slope can go the other direction, too, you know. I mean, according to his logic, why not just make drunk driving legal, you know? Or for that matter, why not make murder legal? And to me, it also oversimplifies everything. For them, it seems like it's an all or nothing proposition. When you're making new laws, it's always going to be a balance between, you know, what's good for society and what starts to become too restrictive. But he just wants to make it an all or nothing thing, and that's ridiculous.
Yeah, well said. And in fact, what they want to do is they want to take it a step beyond that and make it the and in fact they have to a large extent, make it that corporations have virtually all the power in our society, and we the people have progressively less and less power. There's a fascinating study, by the way, just came out, Six Nations Survey. This is from Financial Times and the Harris Poll. Financial Times, the newspaper out of the UK, and the Harris Poll in the United States, of the five largest European countries and the U.S. This is a six-nation study. They surveyed people in the United States and, let's get the whole list here, France, Italy, Spain, Germany, and Great Britain. And they asked the question, do you think a free market capitalist economy, an economic system in which prices and wages are determined by unrestricted competition between business with limited government regulation or fear of monopolies, is the best economic system or not? And in France, only 34% of people said yes, 38% of people said no. In Italy, only 36% of people said yes, 44% of people said no. In the United States, 49% of people said yes, and 17% said no. In other words, in the U.S., we've really done a good job of indoctrinating the populace that if you just let the corporations run everything, everything is going to be fine. Not to worry. Howard in Alabama. Hey, Howard, welcome to the program.
Yeah, on your earlier caller, when you guys was talking about the smoking, I'm a smoker. I realize smoking is very bad. I know all the bad things, and one day I will quit. But as for a business, I think if you are a business and you clearly state that this is a smoking establishment, not only do the patrons, your customers coming in, but then your potential employees also know, okay, this is a place that allows cigarette smoking, cigar smoking. It is a hazard to my health. I do not have to go there as a customer or as a prospective employee. So that aspect, I don't agree with you on protecting the waitress aspect. There,
yeah, well, this is where I said this is a tough one, because frankly, I think that it should be possible in a state that has banned smoking in public places. It should be possible for somebody to apply for a business to operate a smoking business, to apply for a license to operate a smoking business, so that you could have a place where people who work there smoke and people who go there smoke. And I realize that puts me somewhere in the middle of this thing rather than, you know, in the absolute no smoking. I do think, though, that, you know, bans on smoking in public places and in places of business are a good thing overall for society. And at the same time, why should a tobacco shop or a cigarette store or a cigar store, I mean, this is a drug, but it's a legal drug in our society, why should they not be allowed to allow their customers to try their product, for example, in their own store, you know, to light up? I think that there's a middle ground here, Howard, and so I guess to some extent I'm agreeing with you. My problem is, you know, when Louise and I go back to Michigan, where we grew up, in that state, they still have restaurants that have smoking and non-smoking sections. We don't here in Oregon. Everything is non-smoking. And I smoked for the better part of a decade, and as a response to that, my body has just gotten so sensitive. I think I made myself allergic to tobacco smoke. I mean, if I get around tobacco smoke, my throat goes sore, my sinuses swell up, and you know, it stays. I have a hard time sleeping that night. And I go to a restaurant in Michigan, I'm toast, even if I'm sitting in the non-smoking section, because it'll get me. But on the other hand, I think that in any state, if you got a tobacco shop and you've got patrons who are tobacco users, that they should be able to do that. So this gets back to the question of, you know, what's the rational middle ground? Howard, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Edwina in San Diego, California, listening on KLSD, where I'll be broadcasting live from tomorrow. Hey, Edwina, what's up?
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to let you know that I worked over at the Naval Air Station in Coronado as a sheet metal mechanic on the F-18. And I just wanted to let you folks know that, and I can honestly say that there was about 80% of the people that I worked with in that hangar who did not agree with the occupation of Iraq.
Sure, but they're making a living. And, you know, what's wrong with that?
Pardon me?
So your point is that even the people in the military are opposed to the war, or even the people who are working for the military are opposed to the war?
I'd say the people in Hangar 94.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in Hangar 94 as a sheet metal mechanic.
Right. So these are civilian employees.
Right.
Right, right.
And yeah.
The war. Yeah, I think that there's broad opposition to this occupation of Iraq, this ongoing occupation of Iraq, and we need to stop using the word war, their phrase war in Iraq, and start talking about the occupation in Iraq. Edwina, thank you. And I think it's absolutely widespread, and it's widespread in the military, it's widespread. In fact, you've got the large number of generals and flag officers who have retired so that they can speak out. Some days it seems like it's more of them than there are the ones who've stuck around. So, Jeremy in New Jersey. Hey, Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going, Tom? Love the show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to speak about the smoking ban. As a smoker, I agree with it. I hate going into a bar and having it filled with smoke or a restaurant filled with smoke. However, there is certain businesses in New Jersey where you can, like cigar shops and stuff like that, where you can still have a cigar. And it's obviously well known in those places that you can have a cigar, you know what I mean?
Oh, okay. Well, then that's what I was talking about. That's that rational middle ground.
Exactly. Like, people know when they're going into a cigar shop that it's going to be filled with cigar smoke. Not many people would go into a cigar shop not knowing that.
Yeah.
But, when I visit other cities and stuff like that, I like to go to jazz clubs, and if I occasionally want to have a cigar in there, you know, some of them still allow it. And that's where the problem is I find that a lot of those places are cutting that out. And if they had certain businesses that, you know, like the caller earlier said, certain businesses that established that I think that I wouldn't see a problem with that then.
See, Jeremy, if the consumption of tobacco, the smoking, didn't involve spreading it in other people's faces, I'd have no problem with it. I mean, if people wanted to go to a jazz club and if it was legal to snort cocaine or it was legal to shoot heroin or certainly it's legal to drink alcohol, these are all drugs that you take and you take them all by yourself and you don't inflict them on the people around you. But when you're smoking tobacco or smoking anything else for that matter, smoking pot, for example, at some places in Holland, you're spreading that around the room. You know, you're putting it in other people's faces and in other people's lungs. And that's where I think it's appropriate for us to draw the line. So I'd say, you know, if somebody wants to get their nicotine high while they're listening to jazz, let them chew tobacco or snort snuff or something. You know, maybe you can get it in an IV form. 45 minutes.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Infrastructure's eroding, so what if levees break? For disasters, we're not ready. Bush thinks we'll just eat cake, 'cause a dollar is his true god. The people he'll forsake, business will carry on. Glory, glory, Halliburton.
Tell you, my friends, it's time to get out there and get active. Reverend Billy is with us at the Church of Stop Shopping, RevBilly.com, the website.
Thomas.
Hey, Billy. You and I are both in an older movie from long ago and far away, as I recall, called This Land Is Our Land. Do you recall? You remember
that? Is that an old Woody Guthrie song? Oh,
it is, yeah. And I think I'm pretty sure that I met you at the opening of that movie in New York about 5 years ago, but I could be wrong. In any case, I've been following your work for years and years, and the Church of Stop Shopping. And in fact, you were busted in Manhattan facing charges of harassing police officers in Union Square Park.
Well, I was reciting the First Amendment, St. Thomas. I was reciting the First Amendment, and I was just a little bit too close to one of the bishops of that other church, the New York Police Department.
Yeah, 15 feet, they figure, is too close. And you've got a new movie coming out. Morgan Spurlock, the guy who does Super Size Me, has produced it. It's called What Would Jesus Buy? And it's opening in theaters all across the United States coming up soon here. And there's information you can find out about it over at RevBilly.com. Tell us about this.
Well, thank you for that plug, St. Thomas. We're on our way. We're in the car right now on our way to the JFK airport, flying out to San Francisco to the San Francisco Doc Fest, where What Would Jesus Buy will be screened on Friday night and Sunday and Monday. And so we're all set to try to get the American consumers to slow down their shopping at Christmas time. Try to ask the question, what would Jesus buy, child?
That's right, and that's the question, Reverend Billy. What would Jesus buy?
I think it's a trick question. I think Jesus was involved in the gift economy, wasn't he?
There you go.
I mean, maybe he went all the way. Maybe he went all the way up to farmers markets, possibly. But I don't think he was inside a Walmart. You know.
No, he took two fish and made a whole bunch of fish food out of it.
I think he dealt in the miraculous. Yes, I think he dealt in. He went to thrift stores, possibly, and I think that wealthy housewives loved him. Didn't they shower him with clothes and stuff?
One in particular. But we're talking with Reverend Billy of the Church of Stop Shopping, RevBilly.com. Reverend Billy, if somebody encounters you in Manhattan or in one of the, which is where you live and spend most of your time, as I recall, or in many of the other places around the country where you go out and preach, what are they, you know, give us your shtick, if you don't mind.
Well, you know, I just don't think that we're making ourselves rich, prosperous, or even happy, child, by buying things. Back away from the product. Don't run your happiness through advertising. You know, don't take that credit card, make your way towards the supermodel, and try to slot that card through the supermodel's arm to try to get the thing that will make you happy. Don't surround all the orifices in your body with media while you sit in a traffic jam caught between two big boxes thinking that that's going to get you to heaven. That's going to put you in a lake of hellfire, child. And it's just going to make you bored out of your mind. Bored. Hallelujah. Let's back away from the product, St. Thomas.
Hallelujah, Reverend Billy.
Back away from the product.
So, you're really William Talon, if you don't mind my outing you, right?
Oh, you outed me. Hallelujah, well...
You're a performance artist and doing a brilliant job of it, and you've been doing this since 97, right?
Well, the thing is that I thought I was a performance artist at the beginning, but then I became a sidewalk preacher, and then after a while, I was stationed in front of the Disney store and chain stores, and people start clapping, and they start gathering around, and they said, we believe in that too. And when you do back away from running your life by the retail church, you know, when you back away from the retail cathedral, well, then your body and soul starts getting you to do something else. There are other things in us, dreams and memories and crazy things that we've got that we've invented ourselves, St. Thomas. We've got an amazing media empire right here inside our soul, each of us, carrying it around all day long. It's right there. If you back away from the product for just a few minutes, it's like getting off of alcohol or drugs. You know, after a while, you get memories that you didn't have before. That happens with products, too. So we all started doing this together, and now we meet, not hundreds of us. You can call it a church, you can call it a cult, you can call it a group of people trying to get together to stave off a super mall from taking over the neighborhood, whatever you want to call it. We're gathering together, and there's something going on, and we don't call God God. We call God the fabulous unknown, the mother, father, creator that isn't trying to sell me something. Amen, hallelujah. Stop beating me up. I'll believe in something soon enough. Amen, hallelujah.
Okay, I got it. All righty, Reverend Billy.
Amen.
RevBilly.com is the website. You can check it out on the internet. And the movie, What Would Jesus Buy, produced by Morgan
Spurlock. I'll see you in San Francisco, amen. We can't wait to go out to the West Coast.
Yeah, well, have a great time. It's going to be opening in San Francisco. In fact, we're being heard right now in San Francisco on K Green, and you're going to be in San Francisco. When we're in San Francisco, Billy?
Thank you, St. Thomas, for having me on today. Thank
sure.
You.
Hey, Billy, where and when in San Francisco?
Stop shopping, amen, please be.
Okay. I think your cell phone is croaking. So, Reverend Billy, thank you so much for being with us. And the Reverend Billy with the Church of Stop Shopping, and he's on his way out to San Francisco and someplace. I think I had the information here. Yeah, it's at the SF Doc Fest at the Roxy, 3117 16th at Valencia in San Francisco. And it's going to be in New York as a revival, a whole bunch of stuff. You can check it out over at RevBilly.com. So interesting times, very interesting times for Reverend Billy and for all of us, I think. We really do, to a large extent, live in a society where we're told the only way to happiness is by stuff. And we've got to get it that, you know, one of the major ways to happiness is by being, not getting. but now I'm starting to sound like a preacher, so I'll stop at that point. 57 minutes past the hour. Edward Larson coming up next right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. America at times seems like it's on the brink. You know, many of us, I think, from time to time believe or feel like get the sense that we're living in a time when America's on the edge. And yet our country has so much more been on the edge. And we say, oh, well, they're passing these repressive laws. They say, you know, what we're seeing now with the Patriot Act ain't nothing compared to John Adams' Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798. When he threw a member of Congress, Congressman Lyon from Vermont, into prison. Or he ran for Congress and got reelected in the election of 1800. Under the Alien and Sedition Act. So in any case, it's an amazing period of America's history, right around the election of 1800. And Edward Larson, who is the professor of history, holds the Darling Chair in Law at Pepperdine University, the Russell Professor of American History at the University of Georgia, won the 1998 Pulitzer Prize in History for his book Summer of the Gods. There's a new book out about that election, the election of 1800. It's called A Magnificent Catastrophe, The Tumultuous Election of 1800, America's First Presidential Campaign. Edward Larson, SimonSays.com, the website. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me on. And you have got a great show. I've really enjoyed it over the years.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I love this book. And talk to me about the High Federalists. You in early on, in fact, you're talking about on page 35, in mid-1798, the High Federalists pushed through Congress and Adams signed the Naturalization, Alien, and Sedition Acts. And a little before that, you had talked about how the High Federalists and some of the extremists among the High Federalists, like Hamilton, were pushing Adams in a direction that ended up with this huge collision between the election in the election of 1800, which was this battle between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson.
When you think about the High Federalists, sort of keep Vice President Dick Cheney in mind, because they think quite a bit alike. And indeed, that wing of the Republican Party today is the intellectual heirs of the High Federalists and lionized people like Alexander Hamilton. What they believed in deeply was a very strong presidency, a national government that would consolidate power. Hamilton had wanted argued famously at the Constitutional Convention for a life tenure for the president. He, of course, making the president commander-in-chief, centralizing military powers under President Adams. Hamilton had arranged to have a domestic army for the first time, a domestic security force, which he wanted to use to march against Virginia when Virginia passed resolutions condemning the Alien and Sedition Acts. He thought he wanted to take the army in there, which even Adams just rolled his eyes and said, either that man is mad or I am. That sort of activity. I believe Adams was, and Hamilton were sincere in their view. They had a view of of what America should be, and that included a strong centralized government with an economy that was, where they'd preempt state laws. They believed that the economy should be, they should support the creation of wealth and that it would, well, to use a modern phrase, trickle down and improve the whole. They saw England, and England then had a king who had real power, and it had a House of Lords, an aristocratic House of Lords with real power, and they viewed England becoming a great power, and they wanted that greatness for the United States, and this was their vision, and this is how
And perhaps most important, they saw stability. I mean, even modern-day conservatives talk about, you know, the reason why they want to have this kind of an America is it's stable.
They were afraid of there were no democracies back then except us. We were an experiment. And they thought that the people were could not be trusted, that they were venal, that they would follow demagogues, and they wanted stability. And even though most of them were not very religious themselves, Adams or Hamilton, you wouldn't call conventionally religious, they believed that religion was an important prop for the stable society, so they linked up with the evangelical Christians of the day, and religion therefore became a major issue in both the election of 1776 when Jefferson barely lost, and then in 1800 when he turned it around and just barely won.
Well, in fact, that was one of the charges that was made against Jefferson in the election of 1800, was that he would turn this country into a godless state. And in private letters, he was essentially saying, yeah, it always has been. This is a secular state. And go ahead. In fact, let me just toss that to you by way of, can you describe Edward Larson, author of A Magnificent Catastrophe, a brilliant new book, the Republican Party, which then became the Democratic Republican Party, which in the late 1820s, early 1830s, dropped the word Republican, and just today is known as the Democratic Party, the longest lasting political party in the history of the world, I believe, that started with Jefferson, arguably, or Madison, maybe in 1792, how that was different from the Federalists and what the lines of demarcation were in the election of 1800.
There were a whole variety of lines of demarcation, but what we've got with Jefferson and with Madison, who's the real party builder, but Jefferson is their ideological head, intellectual leader, is there was this faith in the people. Now, you can look back, and sure, it was free white males, but it was a lot broader vision of the people than the Federalist had. And there was this, it came out of the French Enlightenment, that just way of thinking that we could trust the people, or at least free white males, to build a country, spread out power with them, try something new, create something new under the sun. They viewed religion, a traditional religion, organized religion, Jefferson religious himself, but in a very iconoclastic way, organized religion as fetters that controlled people. And he saw America as a place of enormous opportunity. He wanted to open the West. He wanted to spread out and let people be new and different people. Something new under the sun would be the closest thing to capture their motto. And they viewed the Federalist as trying to look back and make us on a better England. And that's what they wanted to turn against. So, as you probably know, Albert Gallatin, their brilliant, who becomes Secretary of the Treasury, replaces Hamilton under Jefferson's rule and stays there for 40 years, has this vision of just, opening up the economy.
Along with Governor Clinton. Wasn't it Governor Clinton of New York?
Governor George Clinton, that longest-serving governor of New York history.
Also one of their buddies.
Who pushed these ideas and really believed, he was an anti-federalist who thought the Constitution would be used in a way that would limit a strong presidency, that would limit freedom. And they had visions of freedom. We're talking about here, on both sides actually, brilliant men with just simply competing visions for America. We hadn't been partisan before. They set up the Constitution with the idea that we'd be, you know, have this elite electoral college and people wouldn't be involved, and it broke open in the 1800s, and what we saw created was the modern American two-party system, and the type of ways that Jefferson reached out are just the ways that Democrats can reach out today. Immigrants were an important issue in drawing immigrants into America, while, of course, the Federalists were trying to build walls and drive them out by passing the Alien and Naturalization Acts.
Yeah, it's interesting. And also this was set on a footing of war hysteria and creating the other. You had Adams really whipping things up with the XYZ affair, where he said that Napoleon or the French, actually this would have been post-Napoleon or pre-Napoleon, so the French, during the French Revolution, that they were trying to bribe these three envoys that he sent over to France, as I recall. And the guys who were trying to bribe them were Mr. X, Mr. Y, and Mr. Z, and he's whipping up all this fear of France and then the Alien and Sedition Acts.
And the people trying to be bribed were none other than who he chose as his vice presidential candidate, Charles Cotesworthy Pinckney, and John Marshall, who he appointed as Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. All to keep people in mind of this. The whole battle, and what gave it such a edge, the whole battle was fought in the shadow of the French Revolution, where Europe was being and the established regimes of Europe were being overthrown. A reign of terror was in France, and France was exporting revolution to other countries. And what the Federalists charged is that they were, that the French were going to export their leveling revolution and their atheistic traditions and, to the United States, that they were going to come here and change us. So the result was, that was the justification for passing the Sedition Acts to quiet the Republican press, because they said that'll be a vehicle for promoting French ideas in America and for forming a national army with Alexander Hamilton and its head that was designed to defend against an invasion that Adams knew was never going to come.
Yeah, brilliant. And then George Marshall, you mentioned George Marshall, Jefferson's second cousin, as I recall. Adams, on his way out, his parting shot is to make him Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. 3 years later, he decides that the Supreme Court gets to decide what's constitutional and what isn't. Incredible. I'm sorry, we're out of time. Edward J. Larson, the book, A Magnificent Catastrophe, the title. Check it out. This is a brilliant book. Edward Larson, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
A place in the middle of nowhere with a big black horse and a cherry tree.
Ooh-hoo.
I felt a little fear upon my back. I said, don't look back, just keep on walking.
Ooh-hoo.
But the big black horse said, look this way. He said, hey, that day, will you marry me?
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Hey, I'll be at the Washington Green Festival a week from Saturday. That's October 6th on the main stage at 6 p.m. So if you're going to be at the Washington Green Festival, you're going to be in Washington, D.C. weekend after this, drop by. And tomorrow we'll be doing our show from KLSD in San Diego, California. Christy Harvey on the line with us right now with the Center for American Progress. Hey, Christy.
Hey, how are you?
I am fine, but I'll get better. How about you?
I think I'm okay. I'll make it at least through this week. How's that?
Well, that's
good enough?
That's a good start. We've been doing this thing fairly regularly now for some time, and I really like the, you're looking for those stories that are falling through the cracks, that are under the radar, the stories that we really should be paying attention to and that by and large the media is missing. What's on your radar screen this week?
Well, there were a couple of things that really struck me as things that I would think would be huge front page, lead the news stories that just got a little blip in the news. And, you know, I have that big secret, not so secret crush on Congressman Henry Waxman, for example.
Yes, the mustache of justice.
The mustache of justice. So the mustache of justice is going after the State Department now for two different occasions in which he thinks that they're trying to obstruct justice. And, you don't mess with Henry Waxman. So he's on the case. And he wrote this phenomenal letter to Condoleezza Rice this week, accusing her on two different occasions of trying to stop the Congress from doing their investigating and from doing their oversight. The first one was, you know, we've been talking about all the things with Blackwater and the shooting and the contracting. And it turns out that the State Department, when they found out that Blackwater was going to be investigated, told Blackwater, here's the thing, you're not allowed to turn over any documents to Congress. Those actually belong to us.
You're kidding.
And Henry Waxman said, no, that's actually not how this is going to play.
So the State Department, because the State Department, theoretically, or at some level, I suppose, well, let me back up a little bit. Traditionally, the protection of our embassies has been the job of the U.S. Marine Corps. In
right.
fact, that was part of the Marine Corps' founding purpose, was to protect our envoys overseas.
Right.
And to a large extent, Blackwater has replaced that function in Iraq. And but is still working for the state. And the Marine Corps, in that context, although they report up through the chain of command to the commander-in-chief, they also report to the State Department because they're protecting our ambassadors who are employees of the Secretary of State. And so because Blackwater's taking that Marine Corps function on, Blackwater is reporting to Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State. Am I right so far?
You're right so far. And it really boils down to the fact that the Pentagon is saying we can't have this sort of thing happening because it really reflects badly on the U.S. military and makes our job harder. We need to investigate. Congress is saying we've been lied to a lot with all of the stuff that's going on with contractors in Iraq. We need to investigate. And the State Department is trying to block all of that and saying, here's the thing, this could be sort of embarrassing to us, so we're going to try and block you from looking into these different documents.
So you've got the Department of Defense, which is also part of the executive branch along with the State Department, and you've got Congress, which is the first among equals, a different,
right,
you know, the legislative branch of government. Both of them being obstructed by the Secretary of State, by Condoleezza Rice?
I know. Can you believe it? So luckily, finally, Henry Waxman was like, you know, this isn't going to happen. So he wrote this letter. So also in the letter, it turns out that the State Department was trying to block Congress from seeing these documents that they had that said that the thing is, the Iraqi government is never going to be able to meet any kind of deadline to improve on all of the corruption that's going on. And Stuart Bowen, who is the inspector general for things going on over in Iraq, has actually said that the real insurgency over there is the corruption that goes on a daily basis with these government ministries. And so the magazine The Nation got its hands on this confidential draft of a memo that actually said from the State Department, the Iraq government, quote, is not capable of even rudimentary enforcement of its own anti-corruption laws. And Henry Waxman said, you know what, this is not what the State Department has told me. And
right.
Plus,
we're paying the bills.
Right, right.
Congress is paying the bills, and so they should have the right to author to check into that. Christy, we only have about a half a minute left. You said there was another story that you wanted to point out.
Well, the Transportation Security Administration has hired a bunch of people to stand around in the airport and evaluate your behavior. And they've put all of their technology into this, and they're called behavior specialists. And they're looking for people who bite their fingernails or who they think look a little shady or who fidget too much or who chew on their tickets. And those
That's
are
amazing.
The people they're going to target.
I printed out, you know, you can advance check in for your flights. I'm flying down to San Diego this afternoon. I print out my boarding pass, and I'm recycling paper. And so by accident, I printed it on a piece of paper that the backside had already been printed on. And on the backside is the World War II Nuremberg indictment.
Well, be careful. They're watching for you, Tom. Be careful.
My boarding pass may get me in trouble. Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications of the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Thank you, Christy.
Thank you.
27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back to listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman Program, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors like Small Dog Electronics or Sacred Grounds Coffee or the Organic Wine Company or Purina One, 1-866-380-MEOW. And it's time for our Best of the Rest of the News segment, where we go out to the tubes, not the trucks, the internets, and get some of the finest minds out there. What's going on in the web? What's going on in the news? Aaron Glantz is with us. He's the author of How America Lost Iraq. And War Comes Home, warcomehome.org, and Mark Carlin, the editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com. And Aaron, welcome to the program.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Mark, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey, Mark, great to have you back with us.
Great
Aaron, let's
here.
Start with you. Thank you. Aaron, let's start with you. What are you seeing as the top couple of stories in the news that we should be paying attention to? What's going down?
Well, I always follow what's going on in Iraq and the war here at home. And, you know, we have links to two stories up on the warcomeshome.org right now that I think have been broadly missed by the media but are terribly important. The first is that the General Accounting Office has come out with a report 6 months after the Walter Reed scandal where, you know, soldiers at Walter Reed were getting terrible care when they come back from the war. And they found that 46% of the Army's returning servicemen who were injured and came back couldn't get medical care because the Army didn't have enough doctors and nurses, and that half of the bases across this country are short 50% of the doctors and nurses that they should have to care for wounded soldiers. The second story that we have up on warcomeshome.org related to Iraq that is terribly important is a new report released this week by Amnesty International showing that 4.2 million Iraqi people have had to flee their homes as a result of this occupation. 2.2 million have been internally displaced. 2 million have gone to Syria and Jordan. And the UNHCR is reporting 2,000 Iraqis are fleeing their homes every day. That's roughly 80 an hour.
Wow, and that's War Comes with an S, comeshome.org.
Yes,
Aaron, thank you very much. Mark Carlin over at BuzzFlash.com. What are the top stories on BuzzFlash.com?
We've been following closely this week and actually for a few years since we began the struggle for democracy in what used to be called Burma. And I think that it's an excellent illustration of what is happening there as we speak, with monks being killed, beaten. These are holy men, 100,000 strong, marched the other day. And all Bush has offered is lip service, as he did at the UN. His interest in spreading democracy seems to be focused on nations that have a lot of oil. And there isn't much in what used to be called Burma. There's some offshore oil. And also the dictatorship there, the military dictatorship, which stole the government after a free election, is very close to China, and I think Bush doesn't want to tee China off. So officially, the U.S. is on the record as boycotting Myanmar and so forth. But really, I think it shows the hypocrisy and puts the lie to Bush's claim to want to spread freedom.
Well, I mean, are you suggesting that he should go in with 101st Airborne?
I'm suggesting that he chose to go in with the 101st Airborne and other military units for a war that has lasted longer than World War II because of oil. The issue is not whether or not he should militarily intercede in Burma. The issue is why did he militarily intercede in Iraq and is planning on militarily interceding in Iran.
Yeah, and I think Burma presents a real conundrum for democratic states. And Burma obviously isn't the only one. Robert Mugabe is in a hissy match with us right now as well in Zimbabwe. And that is, how far do you go in trying to protect the people of a foreign land from their own government when their own government is out of control without flipping into the law of unintended consequences, which is what obviously Bush ran into in Iraq, although, you know, many of us saw it coming. He obviously didn't. I would guess, Mark, that what you're suggesting is that Bush should be pushing China, for example, Burma's Myanmar, the military junta. They renamed the country in 1990 when they refused to let the democratically elected government seat itself, that he should be pushing China harder.
That's certainly one element. That what could be done with Myanmar, or formerly Burma, is very complex. I think the main reason we've been watching is here are people who are absolutely dying for peace and have been some time. And what is described as the most Orwellian state, close to North Korea in terms of government control, the state. And the Bush administration, until yesterday, really has done nothing but sort of issue statements and claim that there's boycotts and so forth, but really has done nothing to change the government there. It actually meets their convenience, the military government there, for a lot of different reasons. And the point being that, yes, in the world of diplomacy, which the Bush administration does not engage in, There is much that can be done to help the people of Myanmar. And certainly what happened in Iraq, and they're threatening in Iran, and with the Kyle Lieberman amendment, Bush may very well use that as the case that he claims caused Congress enabled him to go ahead with bombing Iran. We're seeing the difference that an armed intervention is a fiasco and a failure. A diplomatic intervention and engagement may be a success. That is what has not happened with Burma.
Yeah, well said. And you said there was one other story that was in your mind at the top.
Well, that is what we've seen, which is the rolling out of the product, as Andrew Carton once called it, with Iraq, for the bombing of Iran, particularly the thermometer for which to really see that happening is what's happening on Fox News, where they're already doing what they're doing is
they're doing play by play. Sean Hannity over there doing play by play. Here's
right,
where we'll bomb
he's
first.
Doing a scenario of what the bombing of Iran would look like, and so they're
yeah. But I just don't believe that they can do that. I'm sorry. I've been following the Iraq War both from being a reporter there and from being a journalist back here reporting on vets. And the reason they have to scale back the escalation of the war is because he doesn't even have enough troops to fight the war in Iraq anymore. I mean, he's got people going on their third and fourth and fifth tour, and he doesn't have any soldiers left to do anything else.
But Aaron Glantz, they're not talking about putting soldiers in there. They're talking about dropping ordnance on the country.
And I think, Aaron, I would just say that in anyone who's seen No End in Sight, and I assume you have, you know, this administration doesn't plan for step two. They just have the arrogance of achieving step one and then, you know, figuring they could deal with the chaos that ensues. And as Tom said, what their plan is an air war over Iran to intimidate them enough where they feel there would be an overthrow of the government. And once again, that wouldn't happen. In all likelihood, experts say the Iranians would become hardened in support of the current radical regime. But they don't look beyond step one.
Yeah, let's hope, Mark, that you and I are wrong and that Aaron is right. Aaron, and you know, hope and pray. Aaron, warcomeshome.org. Aaron Glantz, what are you seeing flying under the radar? What are you seeing on the future, on the horizon that we should be looking at? The stories that maybe aren't the biggest ones right now, but we should be paying attention.
Well, you know, it's up there as one of the stories is in the media, but I think that you can't harp on it too much. The fact that starting this week, the Congress is beginning to debate whether or not they're going to continue to fund this war in Iraq. You know, Robert Gates was on Capitol Hill yesterday asking for $42 billion more for this war. That would be $190 billion this year on the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. Is Congress going to roll over the way it did earlier this year, or are they going to stand up and at least try to put some kind of conditions on the continuation of the occupation? And I've been following very closely the activities of Iraq Veterans Against the War and other military families groups that are increasingly up on Capitol Hill with petitions trying to get written confirmation from different members of the House that they will not vote to continue the funding. They have about 100 signatures now of Congress people who say they won't continue the funding without some kind of withdrawal timetable.
100 is not enough, but it's a good start. Mark Carlin, what are you seeing as the stuff on the horizon?
Two things. One, what's simmering is this Blackwater controversy where the administration once again showed that Maliki and the so-called purple-fingered government claimed to be democratically elected is just a puppet government. They ordered Blackwater out, Maliki, and the State Department stepped in and said, not so quick, they're staying there. And within just a couple of days, Blackwater was back patrolling down the streets after this latest massacre of civilians by a helicopter. The second thing I wanted to mention was that people should watch this tape of Bill Clinton talking to Anderson Cooper denouncing the Republican attack on MoveOn.org, because it's what the Democratic leadership should have been saying, that the Republicans were just looking for diversion. They're being hypocritical. They attack Kerry. They attack Max Cleland. And there's an outrage and passion, and we haven't seen Bill Clinton in a while, that's there, that really makes us understand how much we're missing among the Democratic leadership.
Yep, I agree. And in fact, what I'll play it when we come back from the break so that our listeners can get it, but they can also find it over at BuzzFlash.com. Aaron Glantz, WarComesHome.org, Mark Carlin, BuzzFlash.com. Gentlemen, thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour, Talk Radio News, coming up next.
Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2270. Well, little George might strike you as a rube, but he's the one that's grinning on the tube. He knows he owes it all to Dad, that and several hanging chads. Yeah, little George, he's smirking right at you. Na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na.
Okay, welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's that clip of Bill Clinton I was telling you about. Bill Clinton on Anderson Cooper on CNN talking about the passage of the by Democrats, by the Republicans in large part, although a few Democrats went along with it, of this resolution condemning MoveOn.org.
I think that there was something completely disingenuous about the feigned outrage of the Republicans in the White House and in the Congress about this. This was classic bait and switch.
Focus on that as opposed to focusing on what's really happening.
I don't have to deal with Iraq. I don't have to tell anybody what I'm going to do. Everything we do in Iraq is obviously right because they said this about Petraeus, as if it was the only issue in the wide world. Come on, these Republicans that are all upset about Petraeus, this is one newspaper ad. These are the people that ran a television ad in Georgia with Max Cleland, who lost half his body in Vietnam, in the same ad with Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. That's what the Republicans did. And the person that rode to the Senate on that ad was there voting to condemn the Democrats over the Petraeus ad. I mean, these are the people that funded the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. And the president appointed one of the principal funders of the Swift Boat ads to be an ambassador. But they're really upset about Petraeus. But it was okay to question John Kerry's patriotism on blatantly dishonest claims by people that didn't know what they were talking about. So it was just bait and switch. It was just, oh, thank goodness, I can take this little word here and ignore what we've done in Iraq and what we're going to do and the outrageous way we gained political power by smearing John Kerry.
Wow. Yeah, there you go. And in passing out the Band-Aids with the Purple Hearts at the Republican National Convention. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Bill Clinton finally gets up on his hind feet and kicks back.
Well, certainly, and why didn't Nancy Pelosi say, whatever you think of the MoveOn.org ad, this is free speech in this country, and you know what? We have really important things to vote on in this country, and we're not going to vote on free speech issues.
Yeah. I don't understand why Harry Reid or Nancy Pelosi allowed this thing to even come to the floor of the House
shocked.
Or Senate.
I am shocked, and I don't particularly agree with MoveOn strategy about that, but to vote on it in the House and the Senate, give me a break.
Yeah, it's tragic. It really
okay.
is tragic.
Speaking of votes, if I can move on.
Please.
The U.S. Senate just tried to attach, or did attach, by a 60-39 vote, the issue of to provide assistance to the states, local jurisdictions, and Indian tribes to prosecute, not persecute, hate crimes, and for other purposes, 60-39. None other, and this is guts, chutzpah, whatever you want to call it, But there you have none other but Larry Craig voting for it, or voting essentially against it, but voting against it. And you did have several Republicans, including Norm Coleman, who's going to be in a fight of his life in Minnesota, Olympia Snow, your very Senator Smith in Oregon, Voinovich of Ohio, Warner of Virginia. Those guys all voted with the Democrats.
Well,
and McCain did not vote. And then I think it was Lindsey Graham said, well, this is going to put the entire defense bill in danger because the president might veto it. The president may veto the defense authorization bill because there's a hate crimes attachment to it. Give me a break.
Yeah, I think he's going to he wants his 190 some odd billion bucks.
Well, I think he may, I mean, it looked today from Dana Perino's briefing like he may do that. Now, speaking of, may veto it. And speaking of Dana Perino's briefing today, they were asked about the transcript of the Spanish newspaper that was said to be from a meeting between the president and the Spanish prime minister in February 2003, in which apparently Saddam Hussein offered to step down, go into exile before the invasion. And the president apparently thought that may be a reasonable at the time. And Dana Perino would not answer it. She said, there's a lot of people floating ideas around about what may or may not happen. Unfortunately, Saddam Hussein decided to defy the international community. And then...
But he didn't. He allowed the inspectors to come into Iraq.
Of course.
She's lying.
I'm just reporting.
I know you just report, but I still am astounded that they continue to try and float these lies and they're not challenged. I mean, Saddam Hussein said, "Bring in the inspectors. I got nothing. Come and look."
Then she's questioned again, and she says, "This is." She says, "Is there reluctance to sort out and go back to in time and talk about what happened leading up to the spring of 2003?" No. I think that's the record of what happened along the way, and this was Saddam Hussein's record, not the president. I mean, what does that mean?
It means that they're trying to reinvent history, and it's nonsense. I mean, it's yeah, amazing. Okay.
I mean, completely amazing. That's one of the things that happened today. Also, as you know, in Mississippi, they are actually, in terms of flood insurance, the Rules Committee decided to bar Republican amendments to flood insurance legislation. This is going to be on the House floor. They're concerned about this. This has to do with some of the Republicans trying to say that they don't want to insure wind damage. Well, that was the whole thing in the Gulf.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, what's the whole point of it? Well, it's the nanny state, you know. They're trying to protect us from protecting ourselves from protecting us, or something like that. Ellen Radner with Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, our first hour, Senator Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie, taking your calls as he does every Friday at noon Eastern Time. And then the rest of the best of the rest of the news, your calls, anything goes Friday. We'll be all over the map tomorrow, taking your calls. So stick around. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.